In the spring of 1932, it seemed necessary to raise money for the scholarship fund. John McCullough, a freshman at Yale and devoted to music, came home one day with a recording which had on its opposite side a most beautiful piano composition by Beethoven called Fiore Lys, written for a little girl on her birthday and played by Arthur Schnabel. A musician whom John had been hearing on recordings and read about, and of whom I had never heard. I said, "That is so beautiful, let's go over to Europe and hear him." John said, "Why not get him over here to play a concert for the Bennington College Scholarship Fund?" We both jumped at the idea, found Schnabel had been making great sensation in Europe, but had only been to the United States once, some years before, advertising the Bechstein piano at Wanamaker's. We talked to the Bennington trustees, who thought it a good idea, but it involved underwriting the concert, and no one cared to undertake it. Mr. McCullough's mother had given money to her grandchildren before her death as a fund to be used by them when 21 years of age. John went to his father and asked if he could use that fund to underwrite Schnabel. Mr. McCullough thought it a good idea for a boy to take on such a responsibility and said he could arrange it. John and I then saw Max Levine, Mr. Schnabel's American manager, and learned that Mr. Schnabel would like to come to America, if under the right auspices. Mr. Levine had heard of Bennington College, but took the trustees' names and said he would investigate and communicate with Mr. Schnabel in a few days. We heard from him that Mr. Schnabel would come, and was delighted to have his first appearance in the United States under the patronage of Bennington College, and would play an entire Beethoven program, Opus 28, the Pathetic Sonata, and Opus 109 and 111, all unusual in those days. The trustees, not many of the music lovers, were not enthusiastic but good sports about it, but returned to musical groups to make a large committee for the concert, with Mr. Alan Wardwell as chairman and Alma Luke Zimbalist, the opera singer at the Metropolitan, as acting chairman. Then our trials began as an influential New York musician spread the news that Mr. Schnabel was only a third-rate musician, as he had done commercial work for Bechstein. Others said they had never heard of Mr. Schnabel, so it was an uphill fight. In the summer of 1932, Mr. McCullough, who was never a music lover or in any way connected with music, received a cable from Mr. Schnabel asking permission to play with the Philharmonic Orchestra, as we had engaged him for his first American appearance. My son, who had underwritten the concert, was still a junior, so could not give the required consent. We were delighted to have the Philharmonic publicity, so Mr. McCullough, much amused at his musical authority, answered in the affirmative. Our concert was set for November 9th, 1932. The week before, we went to hear Mr. Schnabel play the G major concerto for the Philharmonic Orchestra. Our tickets had not gone well, and the time was running short, so we went to the concert in fear and trembling. John McCullough had brought a crowd of Yale boys down from New Haven, and we could hardly contain ourselves with fear and excitement. When Schnabel appeared on the stage and played his first strains of the G major concerto, one of John's very musical friends' hair literally rose right up on end. It was a wonderful performance. The audience roared their approval. Olin Downs and Lawrence Gilman wrote long and enthusiastic editorials for the musical reviews, and both the New York Times and Tribune headlines were Schnabel hailed by a Philharmonic audience. We had a meeting the following Monday morning, and the college secretary reported the Friday sale of seats had been very poor. She was waiting for the office to open to get the Monday report. As usual, the non-musical lovers shook their heads and said they never approved of the concert anyway. Others agreed, so it put the pessimists quite in a hole when Miss Martha Beeler, the college secretary, returned to say that over the weekend the house had been nearly sold out and several days still to go. They were all relieved and happy. until the news came that Schnabel had a severe cold and the doctors feared pneumonia. As it was but a short time for his recovery, our anxiety was intense, and not until the day of the concert were we really sure that he could play. His performance was a noted and distinguished success, and Mr. Schnabel pronounced among the great. He played Opus 28, the Pathetic Sonata, I think I said that before. The house sold out, and many were turned away. It was all a hairbreadth escape. We cleared $5,000 and won endless musical recognition. I always remember Mr. Julian de Grey took the first buck. Such an encouragement to me at the time when everyone was so pessimistic. Mr. Schnabel played again for us in 1933, the Beethoven Diabelli Variations. There was much advanced news about it, as it seldom been heard in this country. It was a success, but not a sellout, as there was a big Tristan benefit that afternoon and one of the early performances of Don Giovanni in the evening at the Met. But we took in over $4,000. The following year, John McCullough again suggested a concert of having Hans Lange with a chamber orchestra of Philharmonic first desk players doing early and rare music. Mr. Lange, Carlton Smith, and Otto Luning searched for unusual pieces in Europe the summer before. There were six concerts of old music. Purcell's Fantasia was played for the first time in America, and there was an unknown trumpet concerto by Leopold Mozart, played by Henry Glantz, and a Mozart bassoon concerto played by Cahorn. Toscanini came to one of the concerts and sat in Mrs. Woolley's box and was very complimentary. The Philharmonic players had never played solos before. After that, they were asked constantly to play on the radio, and from these concerts, many chamber orchestras were started throughout the country. The concertos were too highbrow to be popular, and we simply balanced our budget, but it contributed creative work in the musical world, gave great prestige to Bennington College for its music, and as one public relations man said, gave it $50,000 worth of publicity. So we did not feel it a failure. These chamber concerts, or chamber orchestra concerts, were continued the following year. And Mr. Otto Luning is going to write up about it, if you'll get in touch with him. I want to say that these very personal recollections of the beginnings of Bennington College are only my little corner and part in this very perilous adventure. My contribution was worry, feeling I was totally inadequate, and never having been to college myself and only having had 8 years of education. I saw intimately the struggles and baffling trials endured by Dr. Lee, and how he came through it all and started an influential institution of learning still remains to me a miracle. On the floor, and it came, the last sentence was, would you put this, what I'm going to read to you, right in between this. Dr. Lee could not be released from Williamstown until June, but he came to New York as often as he was able for special occasions and during the holidays. Then will you fill in here, please, this. Our house at 10 East 82nd Street became the college office. As I was giving all I could toward the college expenses and did not want to ask outsiders for running expenses before they expected big money-raising came, my oldest daughter and I did all the secretarial work. It was complicated. As to start with, 100 letters came in from angry feminists that we had chosen a man for the presidency. Each asked separate questions, so they had to be answered individually. Later, President Ham and I had a good laugh about the terminus that he had been attacked by the same crowd when he took the presidency of Mount Holyoke. Mrs. Elon Hooker gave a large lunch at Greenwich, Connecticut. Dr. Kilpatrick, Mrs. Swan, and I went. The lunch brought in $40,000 and enlisted the valuable work of Mrs. Clarence Woolley, who came on the board of trustees. Also at that time, Mr. Joseph P. Cotton and Mr. Vernon Monroe and Mr. Nicholas Kelly and Mrs. Dorothy Canfield Fisher and Mr. Arthur Valentine became members of the board as well. This will come right after, before the sentence which you have. There was a big meeting, a large dinner meeting at the Hotel Commodore at which Dr. Lee made his first speech for Bennington College. Miss Coates, President Sarah Lawrence, also spoke. I hope you won't have any trouble filling this in. Thank you. I'm adding on the college curriculum suggestions, as I remembered from Dr. Graves, Dr. Kilpatrick, and also from the Colony Club meeting, and just educated, and the first educators conference at North Bennington. For entrance requirements, no examinations or marks were to be used. Instead, a directress of admissions was to use intelligence tests, thorough reports from the school from which the student came, and would depend on the whole personality of the girl, giving attention to her attitudes and emotions. A student could apply if poor in some subjects, but gifted in others. Mathematics and Latin could be had at the college for those seeking it, but would not be a requirement for entrance. Dr. Kilpatrick was emphatic that the old idea of mathematics training the mind was a spurious conception, that mathematics trained the mind for mathematics only, that if seeking the means of mental training, physics would be the subject. With a large student application for enrollment, the directors of admissions would try to choose the student body like an orchestra, having in mind enough different interests and localities to make an inspiring student, classes were small. Having in mind enough different interests and localities to make an inspiring student, inspiring and harmonious student body. That the teaching body need not be PhDs or research professors, but chosen rather as inspiring and able teachers, young and dynamic, and with democracy of age rather than the old stodgy teacher with the student, a teacher-student attitude and with an idea of pedagogy. That the first 2 years might have orientation courses and the last 2 years given to the girls having living interest and branching out into our majoring. Should a girl start college with a major interest already, she could arrange her program to include it more or less from the start. The rest of the time given to other fields of interest. Should she be planning a musical career, she could continue her music, giving 2/5 of her time, or 3/5, and 3/5 given to a broadening education such as she could not have the benefit of in a musical conservatory. The arts were all major subjects and included in the tuition. Never done anywhere before. The group tutorial system, as used at Swarthmore, was suggested, also working for honors. As classes would be small, mostly for the two subjects, each girl would work on her own initiative and momentum in expanding and interrelating the different fields. One educator explained the difference between the old regime and the new this way. The old regime was like planting a flower, packing down the soil around it, and then pouring water on it until it killed it. The new regime was also planting the flower, but loosening the soil about it so it could get enough moisture and air and a little water so that it could grow along on its own momentum. To Tuition was to cover the expenses of those who could afford to pay, and a sliding scale scholarship for those not able to pay. The total amount. Many presidents of girls' colleges told me this would be impossible, as girls did not like it to be known that they were on scholarship. So the idea was for the controller only to know which ones were on scholarship. The president, if necessary. But when the college opened, the girls were perfectly frank about it all and told themselves about it, perfectly naturally.